So I'd like to thank the Australian Business Economist for the invitation to speak here today. It's not surprising to me that after a period of subpar growth in many parts of the world, we often hear the term recovery in discussions of current conditions and future prospects. Now, for economists, the term recovery fits within the realm of business cycle analysis quite clearly. I think at one extreme, it implies that the economy is near a low point in the business cycle, with the prospect of much better conditions ahead. A less extreme case would be one where growth has been below trend or potential for a time, leading to a rise in unemployment and spare productive capacity more generally. In both cases, a period of above-trend growth is required to reduce the unemployment rate and make use of that spare capacity. So in my discussion today, I want to consider the extent to which either of these two descriptions might be warranted, both for the Australian economy and for economies offshore. And to do that requires an assessment of where the economy's been, where we are now, and where we think we're likely to be in the future. I think the first two parts of that are hard enough as they are. But as for the third, the bank regularly highlights the fact that forecasting is quite difficult and imprecise. Also, conditions can vary somewhat across different parts of the economy, and this is especially true of the Australian economy right now, given the differences between mining and non-mining sectors and some resulting variation in conditions across the states. So let me start with a consideration of the state of the global economic business cycle. In terms of Australia's real economy, by which I mean the production, the trade, the consumption of goods and services, what matters on the global front is the strength of our major trading partners. This can be measured by combining the growth of each of our trading partners using Australia's export shares as weights, as is done in the leftmost panel of this chart. According to this measure, activity rebounded in 2010, following the worst of the global financial crisis. Since then, overall growth of Australia's major trading partners has actually been relatively stable at close to its long-run average. In large part, this reflects the sizable and increasing share of Australia's exports going to our fast-growing neighbours in the Asian region, most notably China. The relatively weak growth that you can see there among the advanced economies in recent years, that's had pretty minimal impact on our major trading partner growth figure because those economies account for a relatively small share of Australia's trade, at least directly. So from the perspective of our major trading partners, growth has been average for a few years, and our assessment is that that is likely to continue over the next 2 years or so. However, conditions in the major advanced economies are very important to Australia in other ways, via their effects on global financial conditions and through indirect trade linkages. The economies of the US, of Japan, and the euro area are in somewhat different phases of their business cycles. However, inflation is low and monetary policies remain very stimulatory in all of them. Stimulatory monetary conditions in those economies, including the exceptional expansion of their central bank balance sheets, that's led to very low levels of interest rates globally and has contributed to a global search for yield with important implications for exchange rates, which I'll come back to in a minute. So after the recession following the global financial crisis, the recovery of the US economy is now well established. There's been a sizable decline in the unemployment rate, as you can see here, while wage growth and the rate of inflation have picked up just a little of late. The Federal Reserve has now ended the extraordinary expansion of its balance sheet, and markets are focused very much on the question of when the Fed might begin the process of raising its policy rate. Now, this is generally anticipated to be sometime around the middle of next year. Once that process is seen to be starting in earnest, it may well lead to a further depreciation of the US dollar. And, of course, the flip side of this would be a further depreciation of the Australian dollar, and as we've said before, that remains above most estimates of its fundamental value, notwithstanding that depreciation so far, but particularly because of the substantial declines in commodity prices that we've seen over the course of this year. Anyway, so that's the US. Unfortunately, the prospect of even the beginning of normalisation of financial conditions is very much a distant one, I think, for both Japan and the euro area. Japan has made some progress over the past year or more in lifting GDP growth and inflation, and the labour market there is as tight as it has been in 15 years, as you can see from the unemployment rate in that middle panel. However, growth of economic activity looks to have been rather subdued since earlier in the year with the rise in the consumption tax. Wage growth is still very low, and consumer price inflation, it remains some way from the Bank of Japan's 2% target. And given that state of affairs, the Bank of Japan has recently announced a significant expansion in its quantitative easing program. And meanwhile, the euro area, it's still close to the low point in its business cycle. Overall, growth of economic activity is modest at best. The unemployment rate, you can see, has declined just a little, but it remains at a very high level. Inflation and inflation expectations, as you can see, are at quite low levels, leading the ECB to ease monetary policy further recently. So, in short, Australia's major trading partner growth, that's been close to average. It's likely to be around average and possibly even a touch higher for the next couple of years. The major advanced economies, though, are at different stages in their business cycles, but all of them still have very stimulatory monetary policies, and that's keeping interest rates low globally. One consequence of the exceptional expansion of the central bank balance sheets of the major advanced economies is that the value of their currencies has been lower than would otherwise have been the case. And so conditions in the advanced economies will still be important for the Australian economy via global financial market conditions and exchange rates. So that's a quick tour of the globe. Let me now turn closer to home and start by asking how we should characterise the state of the Australian business cycle. Well, I think if you remember the two cases I set out at the beginning of my introductory remarks, I think the less extreme case that I described at the outset is the relevant one for Australia. That is, the unemployment rate has risen gradually over the past couple of years, as you can see here, to a level that's high relative to its recent history, at least. And that's consistent with below-trend growth of economic activity over that period. Growth over this financial year is likely to remain below trend, but our forecast is for growth to pick up gradually to an above-trend pace by about 2016. And there are already signs of better growth in some parts of the non-mining economy, supported by the very low level of interest rates. So let's step through some of those things. When measuring economic activity, a lot of attention is paid to aggregate GDP. I think that's appropriate given that it's a comprehensive measure of activity from the national accounts. The June quarter national accounts recorded an increase in GDP growth over the past financial year to a pace that was actually quite close to trend in year-ended terms, and that's the dark blue line here. Moreover, this pace was a bit stronger than we had forecast as long as a year ago. However, the recently released annual national accounts data, that's shown here in what I would describe as pink, but I challenged with my colours, that annual national accounts data incorporated a downward revision to GDP growth to 2.5% in year average terms for the financial year just passed. And this was pretty much the same rate as the year before that. It was a bit below trend, and it was in line with our forecasts of a year ago. So the source of this downward revision was a bit less growth of export volumes than had earlier been estimated, although it's worth noting export growth still remains pretty strong, even in the annual national accounts data. And then looking at more recent quarters, our assessment of a broad range of timely indicators of activity is that the moderate pace of growth that you can see there recorded, at least in the quarterly national accounts for the June quarter, of about 0.5%, That pace has been maintained, roughly speaking, over more recent months. So if I pull all of that together, what it suggests to me is that growth's been below trend for the past couple of years, 2 years or more. Now, underlying the pattern of growth of aggregate economic activity shown here, there have been some pretty important differences across the mining and the non-mining sectors. And I think those differences are important to help us understand the current state of the business cycle and, in particular, what the prospects are for growth. As is well known, and as Stephen remarked, the economy is in the midst of a transition from the investment phase to the production phase of the resources boom. Mining investment's been declining for about 2 years now. At the same time, of course, exports of resources have been rising significantly as those mining investment projects reach completion. So further rises in volumes are in prospect, particularly as LNG projects begin to ramp up their production. However, because the production phase of the boom needs much less labour than the investment phase, this transition is freeing up labour from the resource and resource-related activities. And given this, it makes sense, I think, just to consider GDP growth excluding resource exports. So here's the same blue line I showed you in the chart before from the quarterly national accounts year-ended growth. That's the total. And then in red, excluding resource exports. So if we have a look at that, we can see that this measure of GDP excluding resource exports has picked up over the past financial year in year-ended terms, but nonetheless, it remains below its historical average. In large part, this reflects the effect of that decline in mining investment that I was talking about. And by our estimation, mining investment is set to decline more rapidly in the coming year or so than it has since it peaked in mid-2012. Given that, I think it also makes sense then to look at non-mining activity, and that can be approximated as GDP excluding both the resource exports and mining investment, and you have to net out imports of the mining investment. So these estimates are somewhat imprecise, partly because of that assumption you have to make about mining imports. Nonetheless, growth of this narrow measure of activity shown here has increased over the past year and is therefore, that's helping, I think, to offset the fall in mining investment, including by absorbing some of that labour that is being freed up from the resources sector. So growth of non-mining activity is actually not that far from its historical average, according to this data. Much of that improvement can be attributed to the very low level of interest rates, and the effect of that is perhaps most evident in the strength of housing market conditions, which are supporting growth of dwelling investment. I think it's worth noting, though, that low interest rates and higher housing prices have also lent to support to the growth of consumption, which has picked up over the past year or so, and notwithstanding the weak growth of incomes. So the strength of this effect is most apparent in the states for which the housing market conditions have been the strongest, which is New South Wales and, to a lesser extent, Victoria. These states are also less exposed to the effect of declining mining investment and commodity prices, which are weighing more heavily on Queensland and WA. Now, meanwhile, while all that's been happening, non-mining business investment, after it picked up following the global financial crisis, it's been little changed now in real terms for about 3 years, and it remains very low as a share of nominal GDP. So I think the need for recovery there is clear. But just to recap briefly, the various measures suggest that growth of aggregate economic activity, it's been a bit below trend for the past couple of years or so, and that's consistent with the gradual rise in the unemployment rate we've seen over that period. Much of the growth of activity over the past year owes to the production of resource commodities and their export, and that uses labour, though less intensively than other sectors of the economy. But even so, growth of non-mining activity looks to have picked up. So, what are the prospects for growth, for economic activity, for labour market conditions? Our expectation is that growth will continue to be a bit below trend for a time, picking up gradually to be a bit above trend pace by 2016. And accordingly, the unemployment rate is likely to remain elevated for some time. Now, that near-term weakness reflects a combination of three forces. We've got the sharper decline in mining investment over coming quarters than we've seen to date. We've got the effects of the still high level of the exchange rate. And we've got ongoing fiscal consolidation at federal and at state levels. In contrast, resource exports, they are likely to make a further strong contribution to growth, with LNG in particular expected to begin ramping up over coming quarters. At the same time, very low interest rates are working to support growth of household expenditure, and in time, growth of household demand and the impetus of that to domestic demand. And the impetus provided to domestic demand by the exchange rate depreciation that we have seen, at least since early 2003, those things are expected to spur non-mining business investment. So given that quick summary of the outlook, I wanted to just really touch on two relevant aspects of the business cycle that are important sources of uncertainty for our forecasts, and one's related to household consumption and the other to business investment. Now, at this stage in the business cycle, it's natural to worry and hear a lot about the possibility that consumption is going to be weighed down by the slow growth in household incomes, driven in turn by the subdued conditions in the labour market. So that's what we hear quite a bit about. Now, it's true that stronger growth of employment and wages, if that was to be the case, would provide more support for consumption. However, that sort of dynamic usually kicks in later in the cycle. And in the meantime, it's reasonable to expect that the very low level of interest rates will enable and encourage households to shift some of their expenditure from the future to the present, including via the mechanism of higher asset prices. And that would see a decline in the share of disposable incomes that households are saving. Now, there are limits to this, and it would be very unwise to build a recovery on a foundation of a sharp decline in the savings ratio. But our latest forecasts, they suggest that there will be a gradual decline in the savings ratio over the next couple of years, and of the same sort of order of magnitude as we've already seen over the past couple of years. Now, a decline in the household saving ratio, that would be consistent with the tendency for labour market developments generally to lag developments in economic activity, including consumption, and that lags typically a few quarters. I've just picked out to illustrate a couple of episodes that are relevant. Consumption and GDP growth, they tend to pick up ahead of an improvement in employment growth, and that which would in turn be expected to occur before we see wage growth start to return to more normal levels. And this was certainly the case in the recessionary episode of the early 1990s and following the global financial crisis. So let me finish with a few comments on non-mining business investment. I've spoken at length recently, including, I think, in this room, to a slightly different audience about the factors that might have led to subdued non-mining in business investment over recent years. In short, I concluded that this outcome had been consistent with a period of greater uncertainty and below average confidence. Both of those, though, seem to have changed for the better more recently, yet firms still seem reluctant to take on risks associated with substantial new investment projects. So if the appetite for businesses, and not just businesses, their shareholders as well, if that appetite for risk were to improve, investment could pick up. And it's hard to know, though, when such a turning point in spirits might take place. But it is more likely, I think, when the fundamental determinants of investment are in place as they seem to be right now. The ready availability of internal and external finance at very low cost, that's one element of that. There's stronger growth of demand, as I've suggested, across non-mining parts of the economy over the past year or so. And measures of capacity utilisation, they've increased to around long-run average levels. So there's a reasonable prospect that business investment might pick up in time. So having said that, let me just note some reasons why the anticipated recovery in non-mining business investment might not be quite as strong as it has been, it was in earlier episodes. But before I get into that, let me stress very importantly that at the outset that if it comes, if those things come to pass, that does not mean that growth of activity nor of our prosperity needs to suffer. So what are these possible reasons? Well, one reason why investment in the non-mining sector might be lower than in the past is just that the services sector, service industries, account for an increasing share of our economy. They've been rising by about 12 percentage points in terms of the employment share of the total economy over the past three decades. Now, this is relevant to investment because, as you can see here, service industries, on average, have much lower levels of capital relative to labour. So in an economy in which services account for a higher share of economic activity, other things equal, the optimal capital stock, at least in the non-mining sector, that capital stock should be lower than it otherwise would be, at least as a share of that economy. However, as I suggested, that doesn't imply that GDP growth will be lower, nor does it suggest the economy will be a less prosperous one. And what matters for those things is whether we are taking advantage of profitable opportunities, using labour and capital in the most productive ways that we can. And also, it's worth emphasising that many services require high levels of human capital in the form of education and training, and those things are not picked up in the investment as measured by the national accounts. Now, investment might also be lower as a share of nominal GDP than in the past for another reason. Over time, there's been a very sizable decline in the price of many types of machinery and equipment, and particularly computers and telecommunications equipment. And so because of that, businesses are able to spend a lot less to obtain a given level of capital services than was the case in the past. So once again, if that leads to a lower level of investment as a share of nominal GDP than in the past, it doesn't imply that there'll be less output growth or lower prosperity. Indeed, given that Australia imports much of its machinery and equipment, a lower price of that capital is very much to our benefit. So let me draw a few conclusions. The major advanced economies, they're in different stages of the business cycle, of their business cycles. The recovery from recession is well established in the US, but has a long way to go in the euro area. Japan, they've made some progress there in reducing the extent of spare productive capacity, but inflation is still some way from the BOJ's target. Nevertheless, growth of Australia's major trading partners, that's actually been around average for some time now, and as best we can tell, it's likely to remain at that rate in the year ahead. Australian GDP growth has been a bit below average pace over the past couple of years. That's consistent with a gradual rise in the unemployment rate that we've seen. Much of the growth this past year owed to rising export resource exports, although growth outside of the mining sector has also picked up. However, with mining investment set to fall much more sharply over coming quarters, GDP growth is expected to be below trend for a time before gradually picking up to an above-trend pace. The very low level of interest rates, that's supporting and will continue to support growth of household expenditure. And in time, that's expected to support a recovery in non-mining business investment and the economy more broadly, including an improvement in conditions in the labour market. But to my mind, if history is any guide, the recovery is likely to proceed in that order, from household expenditure to business investment and labour market conditions. History also suggests that a pickup in business investment will come in time. The fundamental forces are in place to support that recovery. And while I've suggested some of the reasons why business investment might not be quite as strong as past episodes of recovery might suggest, those reasons don't imply that the economy overall will be less strong than it otherwise would. Rather, just one element of expenditure that we measure via the national accounts. So let me stop there and we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you, Stephen, and thank you for the glass half full speech there, Dr. Ken. My question is in relation to some points you made about consumption, household consumption. Globally at the moment we've seen a positive supply shock with respect to oil. US production is picking up. We've seen a price fall for a number of global oil metrics, including the reference price for Australian petrol. If you look at the relationship between the Tapas price and the price for petrol in Australia, particularly unleaded, I'm talking about here, it would suggest that there's a further scope for petrol prices at the Bowser to actually fall. I was just wondering if that was likely and we're likely to see sustained low prices or relative low prices for oil, what's the likelihood of a positive income shock that we could see to households that might actually to support consumption growth?
Well, I think that's definitely on the cards, but not just for Australia, for any sort of major economy that imports a good degree of petroleum as we do, even though we produce some ourselves. I wouldn't overstate its magnitude. I think it's marginally helpful. Interestingly enough, some central banks that are worried about low inflation are worried about this, but I think that's not necessarily the best way of thinking about it. I think, as you've suggested, it's a positive income. It's positive for households' disposable income. But I wouldn't overstate it. I think it's a marginal thing at this stage.
Thank you.
There's another one just here.
So Elias Haddad from CBA. Considering that the RBA still believes that the Australian dollar remains above its fundamental value, has the RBA ruled out currency intervention to push the Australian dollar lower?
No, I think the governor's been quite explicit that we haven't ruled it out. And I think he was asked at a recent parliamentary testimony under what conditions he would pursue it. And I think he sensibly said, well, that wouldn't be a sensible thing to do, to outline that, because it would, by its nature, sort of lose its effectiveness. So we haven't ruled it out. It's still there as an option if needed.
Audience participation with the microphone. This is good. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. My name is Michael Potter. I have a question about quantitative easing. Quantitative easing, at least in theory, would do two things. It would support the economic growth in the country in which it's occurring, but it would also affect the exchange rate possibly the detriment of Australia's economic growth. So you have two opposing effects. One is our trading partner. Maybe I should make it specific. So, you know, like the US, so the quantitative easing allegedly increases US economic growth, but it adversely affects our exchange rate. Has the bank got any done any work on which of those two effects outweighs? So, in other words, is quantitative easing helping or harming the Australian economy?
It's an excellent question. I think my take on it is, you have to be careful and ask, well, what would we have without it? And there's much debate about how effective it is. But I think my assessment, particularly for the US, is that the US economy, after the global financial crisis, needed a lot of support. And this was one means of doing it, given that they'd hit the lower bound on their policy rate. And I think you have to ask the question, well, what sort of world would we have been in without that extra monetary stimulus? And if that's a world that is a much weaker world, then ultimately that's not good for us. But as you suggested, at the same time, it has, and I've noted in my speech, it has had this effect of sort of whatever they would have been, possibly buoying their exchange rates, and the flip side of that is ours. Sorry, reducing their exchange rate, and the flip side of that is buoying ours somewhat. I think it's sort of hard to say, because the real extreme question you have to consider is, what would conditions have been like without very stimulatory monetary conditions? And I think there's no debate that was needed in the US post-GFC. But it's very welcome that we're getting to a point where they're no longer expanding their balance sheets, and we're looking the world is looking forward to the time at which they can start at least to normalise rates. But that's because the US economy is a stronger one. I think that's good for us, but it has the additional benefit potentially of helping move exchange rates in a way that's somewhat favourable, given we think ours are still sort of too high relative to our fundamentals.
Yes, my name is Raymond Kwan. I'm from the Economic Society of Australia. Mr. Kench, in regards to your wording about businesses not taking the risk and also about the easing monetary policy, many supply-side economists believe that if we use the equation MV equals C, there has been a lot of money printing, but there is no circulation of money, as you seem to imply. And many supply-side economists believe that the velocity of money, the circulation to circulate to generate growth, is a function of three major things, which is, of course, the Laffer curve based on the tax income tax incentives, the Rand curve, which is the size of the economy as a percentage of GDP, government's claim on it, and the cost-benefit analysis of the regulatory environment to provide a rewarding environment for the money to circulate. Now, one of these can stop the velocity of money, which means there will be stagnation. My question is that isn't the business cycle more of a, rather than underlying economic causes, it's really the onerous influences of government on one or more of these economic fundamentals or tools? And if it is, what main tool do you think the government needs to use to get back to sustain robust economic growth? Thank you.
That's a good question. But I think there's sort of two parts. What central banks can do is when there's sort of spare capacity in the economy, when inflation is below target, they can and should do what they can to try and support stronger growth and ultimately lift inflation back to target. And that's ostensibly what's been happening globally. It's just been more extreme in some countries because they've hit the zero lower bound for interest rates. But monetary policy has its limits, and it cannot drive growth higher over the longer term. Over the longer term, what it does is it can sort of anchor inflation appropriately around a target. And that makes a good contribution, I think, to an economy, including because people can focus on the business of getting on with business rather than trying to avoid big swings in inflation or deal with big movements in interest rates if you can manage that process relatively smoothly. So then, as you say, I think the longer term, it's really a structural issue, which is not the domain of central banks, but I think it's about trying to make sure we have things like good and high participation as much as we can, and in terms of the labour market, encouraging productivity growth and the like. And in the long run, those sorts of things government can't really drive. It can potentially get in the way of, but it can't really drive. But it tries to set the right environment, and one of the environments is sort of, you know, lots of good competition in product markets, reasonably flexible labour markets with the right sort of protections and safety nets in place. But it's a big question for countries like Japan. What the Bank of Japan's trying to do is lift inflation, but the Bank of Japan cannot drive growth higher in a sustainable and long-term basis in Japan. They have to look for this so-called third arrow, these structural reforms that they need to undertake.
Stephen Milch from Suncorp. We've seen quite a run-up in house prices, although the data this week showed it's really Sydney-centric. As the RBA is apparently looking at macroprudential measures, is there a risk that we move to the implementation of those relatively late in the cycle and possibly exacerbate a downswing or at least a natural curbing of demand that would occur in of its own accord, and hence it becomes this policy becomes pro-cyclical rather than counter-cyclical?
I'd say a couple of things. One, the starting point is not sort of my area of expertise in the bank. Having said so, I won't say very much about it. Having said that, I think firstly what we've said is we're in discussions with APRA about this. It's APRA that has the tools. And then the third thing is, look, it's always possible in any field that you can make policy mistakes, and timing is an important issue there. That's a critical issue always for monetary policy as well. I think in this case what has been said quite clearly by APRA and others in the bank who are expert on this is that the sorts of steps being considered are modest ones in a direction that's already, a path that's already being taken in gradually just tightening up lending conditions sufficiently and making sure lending standards are appropriately prudent. So these are sort of fairly modest steps.
I'll just shout, Warren Hagen, ANZ. The labour force figures at the moment are sort of being mucked around a little bit with, and we're sort of working through that. Are you taking the numbers at face value? You stuck the chart up there, so you're reasonably
sure.
And how much confidence do you have in them, or do we need to wait for some more work to be done? And obviously the seasonal reanalysis in January, February, are we sort of going to be a little bit uncertain about this for another 3 or 4 months?
There's quite a lot in there. I think the picture that we get from something like the unemployment rate, so we step back from it, don't worry about the latest wiggle in the latest few months, is broadly consistent with the picture of somewhat below trend growth over the past period. And so if anything, the sort of annual national accounts made that a bit clearer, because there was this sort of the quarterly accounts was showing GDP growth growing at or above trend. So I think what we have now from the annual national accounts and the generally subdued labour market conditions is a fairly consistent picture. In terms of the recent labour force statistics, they have been quite difficult to read, and the ABS has sort of struggled to sort of generate a picture that sort of makes sense, I think, from the data. And what's happened, try not to go into too much detail, but what's happened is they've made some changes to the supplementary surveys, which are integrated and added on in different months, and they target slightly different sorts of issues. They've been making changes there to sort of broadly improve the quality of those things, and one of the things they've been doing is changing them slightly and moving the months in which they occur. And it turns out when you add one of these supplementary surveys into the standard labour force survey questions, it has a small but noticeable effect on people's answers. What they're trying to do is deal with the fact that some of those surveys have changed this year, having been very stable in terms of their timing and the nature over a number of years. But one thing we're always very cautious of at the bank is not to read too much into one particular series, into one particular month. And there are other labour market indicators which I think paint a reasonably clear picture that conditions are subdued, but there are some indications that at least employment and the prospects for future employment have improved, including things like the various measures of job vacancies and job ads, which have turned higher. They're not particularly strong, but that's positive and encouraging.
So the US, the UK and New Zealand are growing above trend and unemployment is falling, yet inflation is not picking up much. Mm. So what I'm wondering is, do you think that's just a reflection that the upswing in those economies is still very immature and they're still slack, and so it's going to take a while, so it's just purely a question of the cycle not being mature enough yet to generate inflation? Or do you think that there's some structural things happening as well, which maybe we're not sort of fully aware of at the moment, which could be sort of dampening the inflation response to the above-trend growth?
Well, my sense, particularly of the US economy at least, for what it's worth, is it's probably a bit more cyclical, but it's been a cycle that's it's been a deep recession in the US that they're coming out of. So in some sense, it's perhaps not surprising that it's taking a while. And there's an active debate, as I'm sure you know, about what's the right measure of slack in the US. Is the unemployment rate sufficient? Perhaps not. there are other elements of sort of subdued conditions in the labour market you need to account for, and they're not looking quite as promising as the unemployment rate has. So I think there's that. And then in addition, and coming back to the first question, you know, we're possibly commodity prices have come off, oil prices are sort of lower now, so maybe that's being thrown into the mix as well. But that's those things are sort of reasonably positive things for those economies in the longer term, and we're even right now, they may keep headline inflation a bit lower. I think if you look at the US, you know, they've had a couple. The broadest measure of wages growth looks like it's just picked up in the last couple of quarters, and if you kept getting that sort of growth, then that's going to underpin stronger inflation. And it's moved a little higher over the course of this year, not much more in recent months. But they're not that far from, in the US at least, in terms of their preferred measure, the PCE index of inflation, from the 2% target that's there for the FOMC. So I think there's reasonable prospects that in time they'll be heading in that direction or become clearer to people.
Hi, Alan Moss. Commodity prices, as we all know, have fallen a lot. In thinking about the business cycle, how much weight should we give to the flow through to the broader economy of lower commodity prices? And in particular, how much weight should we give to the lower tax revenues and the lower revenues to states and the potential flow through to government expenditure?
That's a good question. I mean, it depends in part what they're going to do in the near term in response to those pressures on their revenues. And that's not for me to say what they're going to do, I mean. I think more broadly, though, you know, it is going to have an effect that is sort of going to weigh on growth. The trick at the moment, though, particularly for iron ore, is that it's not a classic sort of weakening in commodity prices driven by weaker demand. It's finally a lot of supply coming on stream. So there's big increases in volumes. And so from that perspective, it's got to be less worrisome than otherwise. But it's still sort of going to weigh somewhat on the strength of activity in Australia, and one of the mechanisms is through lower tax revenues and the like. But that's where the movement in the exchange rate is sort of important. It's normally an automatic stabiliser, sort of helping to offset those effects. We've seen a recent welcome decline, but it's really only taken us back to the level we were at earlier this year, and yet commodity prices are much lower than they were then. Because the other beneficial thing of having lots of foreign investment in the resources sector generally is that some of those pressures are sent offshore, in that to the extent that there's slightly less profits than there otherwise would have been, foreigners bear some burden of that. So that's sort of a positive thing in that regards.
You actually said in your speech, and I've heard a few RBA people say this, that there's a tightening of fiscal policy. But I think we're finding that, you know, the amount of tightening the federal government wanted to put in place was not happening, certainly not as quickly as they had planned. And if you look at state budgets, big boom in revenue from stamp duty, particularly here in New South Wales and Victoria, and with elections, coming in the three largest states, I'm thinking there might be a bit of fiscal easing at the state level, and particularly the infrastructure spending that's planned in this state. So, you know, could we actually end up with a fiscal positive to the economy in the next year or two rather than the negative the RBA has been expecting?
Well, let me clarify. I think I wouldn't have called it sort of negative. I think what I've tried to say is sort of weigh on growth. There's still, in the national accounts, looking back over the past year, even though there's been a degree of, the budgets sort of have a degree of fiscal consolidation at state and federal levels overall, there's still been growth of public demand. So it's still making a positive contribution, just much less than its long-term average. So I think that's the first thing. And then the second thing is, yeah, there's significant variation, I think, across the states. So maybe this is a bit relevant to Alan's question. You know, with the fall in the iron ore price is going to weigh more heavily in WA potentially, although shareholders who sit back in New South Wales and other states will also bear some burden of that. But you're right, it's possible that the state governments you know, under those under less pressure feel less need for constraint. In terms of the infrastructure that's sort of being talked about and on the books, I mean, I think that's important, but these things often take a while to get up ahead of steam. So I think they're sort of issues further out.
Yeah, thanks. The ABS produces measures of the capital stock, which we can split into mining, non-mining, and the mining capital stock is obviously, I think it's almost doubled in the past 10 years, so that's sort of good news. But the history of the non-mining capital stock is that it's at a very low point compared to the last 40 years. It's actually been falling for quite some time. But it is an argument at face value to say that, you know, we should be getting some investment. You know, we need to update our capital stock. Is there merit to this? I mean, theoretically, there's merit to it. But in terms of the data that we get from the statistician, is there merit to it? And what are some of the issues about sort of using that sort of approach to, you know, looking for rationale for why non-mining investment should lift?
Yeah, no, it's an excellent question. I think there very much is. So another way of thinking about the same sort of thing is, and I think I mentioned it when I gave a speech on non-mining investment in this same venue a few months ago, you know, we've pushed out a little bit our forecasts over a period of time for the recovery in non-mining business investment. It seems like the conditions have been in place for a while, but it hasn't been taking place. And you could ask the question, well, if it's to the extent that it's been delayed beyond where you might have thought it might have started lifting, how should I think about that in terms of it influencing my outlook from here? And I think the right way is, in time, it just means there's more strength to sort of pull you up, because it means if you're not doing very much investment, it means you're sort of falling further behind in terms of some sort of optimal or profitable level of the capital stock. And that's my sense of what's ahead of us, a strong cyclical recovery. To what level, it's hard to know. When will it start? Anyone's guess. But I think all the fundamental forces are in place, and that's what I was suggesting, that the fundamentals suggest that we've got a pickup in non-mining business investment ahead of us. But it's very hard to know when that's going to come about. If you look at some of the measures that are available in some of the business surveys, the NAB one comes to mind because it's come out recently and it's got a long history, which makes it useful, but capacity utilisation is actually around average, and it's lifted over the course of the last year or so. Now, it may need that it needs to move higher still before you get a big increase in business investment. The most recent readings, I wouldn't overstate it, it's just sort of a few months, but the trend in actual investment the businesses report in that survey has been moving higher, and the latest reading is above average. So there, I think there are reasonable prospects, but I think, as you suggest, it's a cyclical recovery that we're looking for here.
Stephen Walters, JP Morgan. Chris, thanks for your speech. You mentioned the US and Japan and Europe a fair bit, but didn't mention anything about China, except in the context of Australia's major trading partners. Like, how concerned are you about whether it's a cyclical slowdown in China, perhaps signalled by what's going on in commodity prices, that it's not just a supply response? Or is it something more sinister about the banking system and property markets in China?
Well, I wouldn't use the word sinister. I mean, I think we've flagged for a little while that there's the weakness in the property market, the housing property market, is something that is a source of uncertainty. We have to remember, though, that it's the authorities that tried to bring about a slowing in their fairly rapid house price growth. It's also the authorities that are trying to bring about a broader easing back in the growth rate of their what they call total social financing, which is sort of a broad measure of credit in the economy. And their efforts to sort of bring those things about, which I think are good things in the longer term ultimately, are paying fruit. And the question is, it's very hard to manage, though, these sorts of cycles. We've seen cycles in the property market before. This one's a little bigger than those already to date. But they're now taking off restrictions, stopping a lot of purchases of property in many cities across China. They're providing modest stimulus in some ways, and those things will take a bit of time to play out. So I think it's sort of watch and wait. Meanwhile, I think, as you suggested in your question, some of the weakness in iron ore prices and is coming probably from the steel market being a bit weaker, linked into property, and an easing in the growth. It's not a decline, an easing in the growth rate of investment broadly in China, which is fairly intensive in the use of steel and therefore iron ore. But they're trying to manage a difficult transition to a more sort of sustainable pattern of growth, both in terms of sort of environmental considerations, the financing considerations, shifting more growth towards consumption, which is ultimately a good thing. And I think the signs are that so far they've been doing a pretty good job of that, but it's a slow and gradual transition. There are risks, and we're sort of attuned watching those. But the China today growing at 7, you can have an argument about exactly what it is, 7% and a bit, is a much stronger economy in many respects than one that was half the size but growing at less than twice that rate 7 years ago. So, I mean, it's still a very positive news story for Australia, I think.